Go.
Well, good morning and sorry for the delay. I'll start without further ado with today's lecture, which is the first in a series of lectures that deals with Germany after the Second World War, i.e. we're talking about roughly the last 60 years. These lectures will therefore focus on the Federal Republic of Germany, the state that you will know as Germany today, and its constitutional founding is the main subject of today's lecture. But let me first say a few words, perhaps in general. Germany in the 20th century is in a way the story of extreme variations on the theme. For it's the story of political and economic instability and indeed catastrophe turning into economic success and political stability. Some even say that the Federal Republic is so stable as to be a bit boring to study. Now, you won't be surprised to hear that I'm not quite of that opinion, and I think that, quite to the contrary, Germany's political system is worthy of your attention and an interesting subject of study. And not only in the decades immediately after World War II, but also more recently. In 1990, barely more than 15 years ago, the Federal Republic, a country of some 60 million inhabitants, united with the German Democratic Republic, a country of some 18 million inhabitants, that had followed a socialist route after 1948, and thus built up completely different structures, both in the economic and in the political sphere. This was an event that was, or is, I should rather say, unparalleled in modern history, and the consequences of this social experiment, if you will, can still be studied today. Let me briefly give you an idea of the level of excitement of the time around unification by showing you a clip from late 1989 and the opening up of the Berlin Wall, a wall that had separated the city for 28 years. It had caused the death of 192 people who were trying to cross it, and many more had been injured. The clip is from the BBC.
It was at 10 o'clock at night that the East German military brought in their heavy equipment, but the wall had been up for 29 years, and it took some force to bring down. They started on the stretch of wall just north of the Brandenburg Gate. Section by section, they knocked it down and hoisted it out. Again, the city celebrated. Among those on hand, the mayor of Berlin, Walter Bonner.
It's another wonderful evening, and you see people are happy all around here. It's really kind of happening, because it's GDR who puts down the wall now. It's not the people, not the wall pickers who do it. We have to do it with their own hands work. It's the GDR government themselves, and we are very happy about it.
This morning, this was a British Army helicopter's view of the gate, the symbol of German unity and the rather changed landscape around it. The work is expected to continue this evening. This part of the wall is in the British sector, and the visitors this morning included the British military commandant. With the wall coming down, is it time for the Allies, mission accomplished, to pack up and go home?
Not yet. I think there's still a great deal of uncertainty in the world around us. And obviously, for as long as that uncertainty continues, and people here feel that we're needed, we'll continue to do our job.
For Berliners, it means that in this particular part of the city, for the first time since 1961, they can see from here to there, and more than that.
It was always more than a wall. It was a symbol, and its dismantling is the symbol of one Germany. Martin Bell, BBC News, Berlin.
But today I will not talk about these relatively recent events of unification and its consequences. There will be a whole lecture devoted to that in the last week of term. Rather, I want to talk about the situation in Germany after the Second World War, the framing of the Constitution and the main elements of that Constitution, or the Basic Law, as it is known. I will also say a few words about different ways to look at and analyze a Constitution, and finally I will talk about some of the general effects that the provisions of the Basic Law had for German politics. Now, I hope you all have a copy of the handout. It gives you an outline of the lecture's main topics and some excerpts of the Constitution. And it gives you a web address where you can have a look at the English language text of the Basic Law. And finally, it gives you a pointer to those parts of my website which deal with German politics. There you can find further links to information about the German political system. If you feel that something is insufficiently clear during my lecture, please ask. You can either do that during the lecture or come see me after the lecture, or you can email me at my address, which is andreas.busch@politics.ox.ac.uk. And a last thing, this term I will experiment by recording the lectures and putting them on the web as enhanced podcasts. The idea is that you are able to listen to the lecture again in your own time, if you choose to do though. But come revision time, that you may find is actually quite a good idea. The podcast will also contain the slides of my presentation, although with some bits, without some bits, such as the film clip that we just saw. So if you have an iPod, you can download it to that. And if you don't, you can listen to it and watch it in iTunes, which you can freely download, as I'm sure you're all aware. Next week, I'll hope to be able to give you the address where you find it on the web. And if I have it before that, I'll post it on my website. But let me straight now cut from the age of the internet back to the end of World War II and start with an outline of the situation in Germany in 1945. Germany's international situation in the summer of 1945 was characterized by three main aspects: its unconditional surrender, its occupation through the Allied powers, and the division of Germany into four occupation zones. After almost 6 years of war, on the 8th of May 1945, the German forces surrendered unconditionally to the Allied powers. Whether this primarily constituted defeat or liberation was unclear to many people at the time. Let me quote to you the thoughts of the publicist Dolph Sternberger, who later became a political scientist at Heidelberg University. I quote, "We did not free ourselves of the tyranny of the Third Reich by ourselves, nor were we, in the proper sense, liberated by others. The tyranny was destroyed, but at the same time, the German people as a whole were defeated and the German territory totally occupied. This was unavoidable, yet highly disastrous. We did not liberate ourselves, nor were we liberated. However, certain defined liberations were imposed on us." End of quote. One may add that dispute over that question, defeat or liberation, continued into the 1980s, a testament to the different perspectives on the past in German society. Another dispute was the question whether, with the unconditional surrender of her armies, Germany herself had ceased to exist. But that debate was probably only of real interest to legal scholars, as on the ground it was quite evident that all German central authority had ceased to exist. A vacuum, as Peter Pulzer has put it, was there, and the Allied powers understood quickly that the task of running Germany and her millions of inhabitants now fell upon them. In June 1945, the Allied powers asserted their supreme authority over Germany. But they had no common plan of what to do with it. In fact, they differed rather considerably as to their plans regarding Germany. Also, their plans were neither very specific nor were they compatible. Even within the American administration, for example, quite different ideas were present. One extreme was marked by the plan put forward by the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, who called for a division of Germany into seven or more states, the complete destruction of its industrial capacity, and the transformation into a territory of agricultural character. These states should remain under Allied control for at least 20 years and be given no economic support whatsoever. Indeed, Germany was split into four occupation zones, each of which was administered by one of the Allied powers: the eastern zone by the Soviet Union, most of the north by the British, most of the south by the Americans, and the zone in the southwest bordering on France by the French. In addition, the four powers shared into the occupation and administration of Berlin, the German capital, which was also split into four zones. Although the declaration of Potsdam in the summer of 1945 had declared the aim of equal treatment for all Germans and that Germany would be treated as one, politically and economically, things developed very differently, rather quickly. So much to the international situation of Germany. Even more dire seemed the domestic situation. First of all, Germany was in large parts physically destroyed. The cities and industries lay in ruins. Hitler had left the Germans, in Gordon Craig's words, I quote, nothing that could be repaired or built upon. Looting and rape, both by incoming soldiers, especially in the east, and vengeful surviving slave laborers, dominated the immediate days after surrender. There are countless tales of terror and horror. Public authority and economic life had come to a standstill. A journalist from the New York Herald Tribune described Berlin at the time as, I quote, more like the face of the moon than any city I had ever imagined. In addition, literally millions of refugees were on the move, fleeing from the Russians in the east or being expelled from Poland or Czechoslovakia. Altogether, some 12 million, with hardly any possessions left but what they carried with them, moved into West German territory. You can imagine what additional problems this brought about, if only in terms of administration, housing, and provision of food. The occupying powers, therefore, needed skilled German administrators to help them with the situation. But of the few that were available, many had been supporters of the Nazi regime. A massive effort of denazification was launched to sort out active Nazis from those who had only been passive supporters. Denazification was thus largely limited to the public sector, a fact that can be criticized, but a result of the immediate need. And even so, this was a large undertaking, as the questionnaires that had been filled out also had to be processed. As many as 1.5 million already by March 1946 in the American occupation zone alone, and overall some 13 million of them. As a result, German administration was largely decapitated, as most senior officials had been active members of the Nazi Party. Also, doing justice proved really difficult. Too often, the small fish were prosecuted while the big fish went unharmed. This served to undermine the legitimacy of the whole process. Together with the sheer cost of administering Germany through Allied personnel, it ultimately led to a more relaxed handling of the issue by the Americans, as had been the case all along in the French and British occupation zones. All in all, denazification cannot be said to have been a resounding success. But efforts to teach Germans democracy continued under the label of re-education. This was necessary because most Germans had practically no experience in democracy. That was certainly true for the younger Germans who had known nothing but Nazism. Many of those who had been politically active in the years prior to 1933 had suffered under the Nazis or had been killed in the war. It comes as no surprise then that the task of rebuilding German democracy fell largely on the shoulders of the elder generation. No one symbolizes this better than the first chancellor, i.e. prime minister, of the Federal Republic, Konrad Adenauer. By the time he was elected, he was already 73 years old, and he was to remain in office for 14 years. To sum things up, Germany's situation was dire in 1945, both domestically and internationally. But within 2 years of the end of the war, things had changed, due mainly to developments in international relations. As the confrontation between the West and the Soviet Union, the so-called Cold War, took center stage in world politics, Germany found herself making the transition from defeated enemy to sought-after ally. Thus began the steps towards reconstruction of German statehood at the price of a divided country, with one part on the side of the West and the other on the Soviet side. The building of West German democracy took place first from the bottom up. The communal structures were revived first because of the necessity to overcome the problems in the cities and the villages. The destruction of homes, of hospitals, of schools, and of roads. Along with them came the other more formal structures of political life, political parties and regional structures. The first parties were permitted as early as summer and autumn 1945. Like newspapers and broadcasting, they had to be licensed by the occupying powers to ensure that they were not that they were led by non-Nazi, reliable, democratic persons. Some of these parties, like the Social Democratic Party and the Communist Party, whose leaders had been in exile or in concentration camps, were able to build on organizational structures that they had had before the Nazi regimes. Others, like the Christian Democratic Union, were new creations, in that case, a cross-denominational Christian party. Lots of parties sprang up and competed for votes, as you can see on this slide. Local elections were held in 1946, and the next stage were regional elections. The regional elections resulted in parliaments for the Länder, which had been set up as administrative units by the occupying powers. The Länder, therefore, predate the Federal Republic, a fact that is still of some importance today, and the practice of what is often called cooperative federalism also dates back to the time when there was no central state in Germany, just the Länder. Germany had been an economic entity before, and being split into four zones with different administrations cut across many vital lines of economic life. The enormous task of physically rebuilding Germany was made even harder by this. In addition, the winter of 1946-47 was one of the coldest in memory. The suffering of large parts of the population encouraged cooperation across the zonal borders, not least because it was feared that public discontent could lead to a revival of Nazism or a turn towards communism. In 1947, the British and American occupation zones joined to form the so-called Bi-Zone. Within it, an economic council was set up, which consisted of representatives chosen by the Länder parliaments, the first interzonal representative assembly of the West Germans. In addition, the summer of 1947 brought the onset of the Marshall Plan and its aid from the United States, inflows of funds to help economic recovery in Europe. Germany was included in this help and profited enormously, a clear sign of its transformation from enemy status to strategic asset. Economic success was important, after all, in the struggle between the systems. As West Germany started to flourish, it seemed to demonstrate the superiority of Western political and economic concepts over those of the Soviet bloc. West Germany can thus be said to have been an early example of the theory that political integration will come about as a result of economic integration. The joint economic administration of the Bi-Zone, which was set up in Frankfurt in June 1947, can, with hindsight, be regarded as the predecessor of the federal administration. When one of its members, a professor of economics named Ludwig Erhard, implemented his plan for currency reform in the Western zones, that marked the birth of the Deutschmark and a further stepping stone toward the creation of a West German state. Now, before I start to talk in detail about the German constitution, I want to briefly look at an important issue about constitutions. The reason is that one can look at them in rather different ways, and I want you to be aware of them. First of all, you can see a constitution as a book of rules that states how politics operates. It specifies which institutions there are, which powers they have, which processes go on within the polity, whose consent is required for what, procedures for complaints, etc., etc. It's a, in a way, you can look at it as a manual for understanding the mechanics of the polity. On the other hand, you can see a constitution as expression and result of certain power relations and the dominance of one ideology over another. Viewed in that way, a constitution becomes a statement of a certain set of values and implicitly a rejection of other values. The German constitution, for example, makes the provision of a welfare state a matter of constitutional imperative. It is thus not impartial in any debate on the welfare state, and it is mainly for such reasons that the drafting of constitutions is an issue of some debate, as could be witnessed in Central and East European countries over the last decade. The last point of view that I want to mention is that of a constitution that... Sorry. Too many gadgets. A constitution has a set of constraints on what governments can do. This is, on the one hand, deeply embedded in the historic German tradition, where in the course of the 19th century, constitutions gradually restricted what governments could do as Germany moved towards a liberal democracy. On the other hand, it was, of course, a lesson drawn from the excesses of the absolute dictatorship in the Nazi period. It is thus no coincidence that the Basic Law starts with fundamental rights that are unalienable and severely restrict state action. But before I go into more detail on its content, let me say a few words about the way the Basic Law was drafted. The link between the Cold War and the birth of the West German Constitution is very clear. Only 3 weeks after the beginning of the Soviet blockade of West Berlin in June 1948, the Western Allied presented the prime ministers of the Länder the so-called Frankfurt documents. They contained an invitation to proceed with the creation of a West German state. While the Allies would retain substantial residual powers, which were to be defined in an occupation statute, this offer went much further than the status quo and granted considerable rights to self-governance. Of course, they did not go quite as far as some German politicians had hoped, and they also presented a dilemma, because this new state would at the same time manifest the division of Germany. But it was the start of new German statehood. To draft the constitution, a parliamentary council was assembled, consisting of 65 members who were elected on the Länder level and reflected the strengths of the various parties. The CDU and the SPD both had 27 members, the Liberals 5 and the Zentrum, a Catholic party, the Communists and the DP of Lower Saxony 2 each. Thus no single party was in a position to dominate the proceedings. While the president came from the CDU, the SPD had the post of chairman of the powerful General Committee, the Hauptausschuss. The main conflict in the council's proceedings was concerned with the issue of centralization. Here, cleavages emerged along party lines and along regional lines. While the SPD favored a strong central state, the conservatives, especially in the Bavarian CSU, demanded strong decentralization. In the CDU, a split emerged between the southerners, most intent on decentralization, and those from the north. Much of it was concerned with questions of finance and of taxation. In the end, a compromise was reached after Allied intervention. Tax rates were to be uniform, but they would require the consent of the Länder through the second chamber, the Bundesrat. Taxes were divided into three sorts: those whose yields went to the federal level, those whose yields went to the Land level, and those whose yields were shared between the two levels. Each change to this, of course, requires an agreement of all the parties involved. And you get an idea from this of the complexities of federalism here. I'll talk about this in my lecture in fifth week. The route the Parliamentary Council followed was determined largely by the Conference of the Prime Ministers of the lender who had agreed on an agenda and had provided a draft through a committee of experts. This is again a demonstration of the great influence the constituent lender had in the creation of the Federal Republic. The very self-assured way in which these prime ministers act in German politics to this day is largely attributable to the fact that it was the lender who founded the Federal Republic, not the other way round. This is clearly different from a situation where certain rights are devolved to regional structures by an all-powerful centre that can, if it wishes, take them back again, as is, for example, the case in the United Kingdom over the last decade. The Basic Law was meant to be a temporary measure, and that is already evident in its name. It's a basic law and not a constitution. But it is also exemplified within it, in Article 146, which reads, "This constitution ceases to be in force on the day on which a constitution adopted by a free decision of the German people comes into force." Certainly nobody at the time would have thought that it would still be in force after almost 58 years and that it would survive even German unification largely unaltered. The French, of course, have a saying, rien ne dure que le provisoire, but it should also be mentioned that the German constitution changed considerably during these decades, and I'll come back to that in the last lecture of this term. But what does the structure of the Basic Law look like? What are its provisions? For the remainder of the lecture, I will give you an outline of the most important features and provisions of the Basic Law. But I would strongly encourage you to read through the text yourself. On the handout, I've given you the internet address where you can find an English language version of the Basic Law. The Basic Law as it stands today, not, I should say, the 1949 version. But the things I will now talk about have not changed since the original version. The Basic Law starts with a catalogue of fundamental rights that contains 19 articles, a symbolic gesture which is meant to emphasize that they are to be put before all else, and clearly a reaction to the complete contempt in which these rights were held by the Nazi state. Let me quote from Article 1. "Human dignity is inviolable. To respect and protect it is the duty of all state authority." And Section 3 reads, "The following basic rights are binding on legislature, executive, and judiciary as directly enforceable law." In addition, this section guarantees, among other things, the right to liberty, equality before the law, and equality between man and woman, freedom of faith, freedom of expression, freedom of association and of movement. And these are not mere guarantees, but the government has the duty to protect these rights, and they also deal with such issues as education, family, and career choice. Article 20 contains what is often called a summary of the Constitution. It defines the Federal Republic of Germany as, I quote, "a democratic and social federal state." A democratic and social federal state. It's thus important to note that a social state, as I already said earlier, is a constitutional requirement in the Federal Republic, although the precise level of what the state has to provide here remains, of course, to be determined. And it has also varied considerably over time. But the state would face difficulties if it were to abandon the provision of welfare services completely. The importance of federalism I have already stressed repeatedly. In addition, we will have a lecture in 2 weeks devoted solely to it, so today I will not go into the details. The centrality of federalism to the Federal Republic's political system is also made evident by the fact that it is one of only three principles that are protected by the so-called Eternity Clause of Article 79. This means that even with a two-thirds majority, and that's the majority required in both houses of parliament to amend the Basic Law, even with a two-thirds majority, federalism cannot be abolished from the Constitution. Let's now have a look at other institutions in the political system. The center of political power clearly rests with the federal chancellor. Article 65 declares, the chancellor determines and is responsible for the general policy guidelines. The position of the chancellor is considerably strengthened. The position of the chancellor is considerably strengthened by what is one of the true innovations in the Basic Law, the so-called constructive vote of no confidence. What does that mean? Let me read to you the wording of the respective article of the Basic Law. You also find it on the handout. Section 1. The Bundestag can express its lack of confidence in the chancellor only by electing a successor with a majority of its members and by requesting the president to dismiss the chancellor. The president complies with the request and appoints the person elected. Section 2 reads, 48 hours must elapse between the motion and the election. This was a direct result of Weimar experiences when a parliamentary majority could repeatedly agree on dismissing a chancellor from office, but not on electing a new one, leading to a standstill in government. The new provision avoids the possibility of such a crisis, and as a result, only once in 50 years has a chancellor been voted out of office by the Bundestag, Helmut Schmidt, in 1982. Another attempt to unseat Willy Brandt in 1972 failed. Also contrary to the Weimar Constitution, the presidency was limited to purely ceremonial functions and not elected by popular vote, but through the two legislative chambers, the Bundestag and the Bundesrat. The president thus lacks the direct legitimacy that could turn him into a political rival of the chancellor. Another institutional innovation over the Weimar Constitution is the creation of a federal federal constitutional court. Contrary to the model of the United States Supreme Court, the German court deals exclusively with constitutional matters. It acts as arbiter for disputes of responsibility between different institutions and layers of government, above all the lender and the federal government. In addition, it has the sole authority to interpret the Basic Law, and it can be addressed by any citizen who feels that his or her fundamental rights have been violated by public authority. The court, by the way, is located in Karlsruhe in the southwest of Germany, and that is no coincidence. You will find that many important political institutions in Germany are not located in the capital. Again, a manifestation of federalism. The Constitutional Court also plays an important role in what has come to be known as the Basic Law's concept of combative democracy, or democracy prepared for self-defense. This is another instance where lessons were drawn from the experiences with the Weimar constitutions, where provisions of the constitution had been used to fight the constitution itself. In the Basic Law, even the fundamental rights find their limits if they are abused to fight the very principles that grant them. Let me quote from Article 18. Whoever abuses freedom of expression of opinion, in particular freedom of the press, freedom of teaching, freedom of assembly, of association, privacy of letters and secrecy of post and telecommunication, property or the right to asylum, in order to combat the free democratic basic order, forfeits these basic rights. Such forfeiture and the extent thereof is determined by the Federal Constitutional Court. This is a powerful instrument, and I should therefore add that luckily these provisions have so far had no practical importance. An application to limit a citizen's aforementioned freedoms has only been made a handful of times in more than 50 years, and it has never been granted by the Constitutional Court. Lastly, it's important to mention that the Basic Law provides what one might call interfaces for joining international cooperation, such as international defense organizations, for example, and thus partially relinquishing sovereignty. Also, European integration is explicitly formulated as a constitutional goal, a wish perhaps only when Europe lay in ruins after the war, but very modern these days. You find that in Article 24 and Article 23. Of course, a constitution is not a perfect script for everything that happens in politics. Not all of that is determined by the provisions of the constitution, in Germany no more so than in other countries. Other aspects, in addition to constitutional provisions, play an important role as well. So to round up today's lecture, let me emphasize two. First and foremost is the fact that the Federal Republic is characterized by coalition government. Only one of its 15 parliaments so far has resulted in single-party government. In all the other cases, coalitions had to be formed, which consisted of two parties, normally one of the two big parties, CDU and SPD, and one of the small parties, the Liberals and the Greens. You will likely have heard that Germany is presently governed by a so-called Grand Coalition of the two big parties, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, under the country's first female chancellor, Angela Merkel. Coalition government does, of course, have consequences for politics and for policies, as in the tendency to favor consensus politics. Political actors are often required by the Constitution to collaborate with actors from other institutions or indeed other parties. Any German government, for example, cannot ignore the opposition to the extent that it is possible in the United Kingdom, if only for the fact that a second chamber exists which may have a different party political majority. That was the case for a considerable time prior to the last general election, and it contributed markedly to Mrs. Merkel's predecessor, Chancellor Schröder, engineering an early general election, because he found himself not only in a coalition with the Green Party, but also in a less formal relationship with the Christian Democrats, who commanded the majority in the second house, the Bundesrat. Schröder therefore argued that he could not govern properly under such conditions. One of the consequences of coalition government is a high degree of stability and an adversity to radical change. But it is easily explained by a combination of historical experience plus institutional provisions plus coalition government. So Germany has been analyzed by the American political scientist Peter Katzenstein as a, quote, semi-sovereign state. That was true internationally, at least until 1990. But it is also true domestically, and it remains true due to a combination of many actors being tied together and forced to collaborate. None of them is thus fully sovereign and able to go it alone. We will come back to that topic repeatedly in the weeks to follow. This is all for today's lecture. Next week we'll look into the main institutions of the Federal Republic, the legislature and the executive, and how they interact. Thank you.